Life is either an incredible adventure or it is nothing at all. These words have fascinated me. It stirred my soul and made me want to experience all there is in this world. And I often find myself challenging the conventional wisdoms of health and pushing the boundaries of performance and longevity. In this series, I turn to psychologists, physiologists, neuroscientists, physicians, athletes, academics, performance coaches, authors, all global experts in their chosen fields to find out the answer to one question, perhaps the most important one of all. What does it take to live life at the human edge? Join me, Dr. Marcus Rani, your champion of well-being, as I find the answers in our exclusive series, The Edge. Hi, everyone. This is Doc M. I'm your champion of well-being, and welcome to another episode of The Edge. I'm super excited this week because I've really been waiting for this conversation with this guest, and you're going to understand why after I give you her introduction and we get into the conversation as well. Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, she is a research psychologist and semi-retired professor in the University of Calgary's Cumming Medical School in Canada. For many years, she's been involved in studying developmental disorders in children, especially ADHD and reading disabilities as well. And that led to her role in looking at the way nutrition affects mental health and brain development as well. She is the co-author of the book, The Better Brain, which talks about how we can search for a cure for mental health and its issues, not only within medicine, but actually within the role of food and nutrition as well, managing stress, anxiety, depression, ADHD, and through other nutritional interventions as well. She's established two nutrition and mental health funds managed by completely independent community foundations. She's studied nutrition from many different perspectives, and I can't wait to jump into the content with her. Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for that very lovely introduction.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have you with us. And a question I love asking all of our guests, particularly now because we all meet each other virtually, is where are you in the world and what's it like where you are?
Well, I'm in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, which is in the western part of the country. And Alberta as a province has been doing not too badly lately. We're up to about, I think, over 60% vaccinated, and about 3 hours from now, I'm getting my second shot of the Pfizer. So I'm very excited about getting that. I think it'll make me feel a lot more comfortable.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank you. It's my first Canadian guest of the series. So that's a fantastic start. I'm going to begin with a very simple fundamental question, something that we all have probably learned incorrectly at school. And it is, what is food?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I heard a very famous individual who I cannot name the other day say that food was just whatever you put in your mouth. And that's not what food is. Food is what we have to consume in order to build our cells and to enable our cells to function so that all of our organs can function. And so when you look at it that way, then when I tell you the following fact, you'll see why it's the most horrifying thing that I've learned in the last at least 5 years. And that is that in North America, anyway, and I suspect it's different in India, and we can talk about why, but in North America, literally more than 50% of what we are putting in our mouths does not qualify as food. And that's a horrible thing, because when you cut your micronutrient intake, and I can explain that word later, but cut your micronutrient intake by 50%, voluntarily, then we have a big social experiment going on. And I think we're seeing the results already.
Yeah. So you're saying half of everything that's consumed, that we literally put in our mouth, that's not food. And that's because it's a substance, but there's no nutritional benefit to it.
Right. Nothing is black and white.
Yeah.
And not in anything. Not in politics, not in nutrition, nothing. But ultra processed, it's called ultra processed food. I have trouble with that label because, as I'm telling you, it isn't food. But ultra processed products do have the macronutrients, and that is protein, fats, but they're usually the wrong fats, and carbohydrates, but they're usually refined carbohydrates. So the macronutrients are there. but they don't have any of the micronutrients, which are the minerals and vitamins and the good essential fatty acids. And they don't have all the other phytonutrients that we get from when we eat our food from plant sources. So they are nutrient free from the point of view of what we know our brain needs all the time, but there are the macronutrients.
And that's really important because people typically think about it through the lens of weight loss, but as we're going to see through this conversation, the role of food as medicine has got so many other benefits as well. People are very focused on that macronutrient consumption of the plate, like half the plate should be X fibers, X fruit and vegetables. Then there's a carbohydrate, there's a protein, there's a fat intake, etc. But what we're really focusing our energies towards is this idea of micronutrients and where that fits into the calorie or what we therefore put into our mouths ultimately.
That's right. The micronutrients really are not, they're a whole separate issue from calories. Yeah. The micronutrients are what our cells need to grow, what our cells need to function.
So let's maybe ask the follow-up question, which is if the quality of food is going down. Obviously, there's a choice between eating ultra-processed foods, but even within the other remaining 50%, is there any evidence and science around the quality of that food with regard to the nutrients, the micronutrients within that? And then the follow-up to that would be, what might be the causes of that reduction in quality?
Yeah, this is actually a kind of discouraging topic, Marcus. The truth is that there's very good evidence accumulating that the nutrient density of our food is going down. Mm. And a lot of it has to do with soil, which is not properly balanced. It also has to do with the fact that current estimates are that something like 97% of the arable land in North America is saturated by glyphosate, which binds up the minerals from the soil so that our plants cannot grab them as well and cannot use them to synthesize the vitamins we need. And also, I mean, in our book, we talk about the problem of climate change because ironically, you would think that the increased carbon dioxide in the air would make plants grow more, and they do get bigger, perhaps, in some circumstances. It is also reducing the nutrient density of our food. So we have a lot of really big discouraging factors there that are so hard to solve. But there are people in the regenerative agriculture field who are trying very hard to get the word out of the importance of improving the mineral density of the soil. I should probably add something here because your listeners, I've discovered people don't always know how we get our vitamins and minerals, and they don't understand that we cannot synthesize vitamins or minerals, except some of the little, if our guts are working well, if we have a healthy microbiome, some of those bacterial elements can in fact manufacture a very small amount of the B vitamins, but it's so negligible, it's not worth looking at. So how we are supposed to be getting our food is this way. Plants absorb minerals from the soil if the minerals are there. And that now is a really big if in soil that's been turned and used for many years. And farmers have been putting on basically just fertilizer, which is NPK, which is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, sometimes some calcium, but there should be at least 15 minerals in a healthy soil. Then plants absorb those minerals, and they do a lot of things with the minerals, of course. I mean, they're geniuses at photosynthesis, which we can't do, etc. But they also synthesize approximately 15 vitamins. Mm. So then we come along, we eat the plants, or we eat the animals that eat the plants, and we should be getting roughly 30 vitamins and minerals. And it appears as if we no longer are.
There was a very powerful slide present at a talk you gave a couple of years ago. And I think you were looking at soil samples across North America, maybe parts of Canada, and actually measuring the levels of each of these key elements. And I think apart from whether it was magnesium, everything else was below the 50% of the recommendation line. And that was a staggering graph to just sit back and see.
That's true. That was a random sample. And it was across three Western provinces. So British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan. Oh, actually four. Manitoba was in there too. And those samples were shocking. And, you know, buried in there, I don't know if I mentioned it, I don't always have time to mention it. People are always saying, well, what if I eat organic? People don't understand that organic means pesticide and herbicide free. And that's a worthy goal in itself. Absolutely. But it doesn't mean nutrient dense. But it just happened that in those, I think we had about 40 samples, we just coincidentally had one sample of an organic farm that was almost adjacent to one sample of a non-organic farm. And you know, the organic farm, we think of them, organic farmers are better stewards of the soil. I'm pretty sure in general that's true, but in that one sample, there was really no difference in nutrient density.
It's really quite scary. And I think, you know, for the listeners who are watching this from parts of India and various parts of Asia as well, we have been on this pursuit of Western philosophies for so many years. And one of the things that we've inherited, the SAD diet, and I'm actually happy it's called SAD, which stands for Standard American Diet, because in many very ways it is sad. It's sad to consume it because it's lacking the macronutrient, but also now more importantly, as we've learned, the micronutrients as well. What was fascinating for me, Dr. Kaplan, when I was going through your work is that typically when a clinician thinks about the role of nutrition, or even when one of our viewers might be thinking about the role of food and nutrition in their lives, they look at it through the lens of physical health, either management or keeping chronic diseases at bay, or trying to focus themselves towards performance and longevity, which is honestly how I got so fascinated by this area as well. But your attack on this is coming from a very interesting perspective, which is around the relationship between what you eat and your brain health, hence the title of your book, The Better Brain. Before we get into the science of that, help us understand, how is it that you arrived at this destination in your journey, your career journey?
First of all, I just want to point out that I often entitle my lectures Nutrition Above the Neck.
Nice.
Because I'm often, like in a symposium or something, there are all kinds of people speaking about diabetes and cardiac disease, et cetera. And these are all very important. There are amazing breakthroughs coming. But the brain it's the greediest organ that we have in terms of nutrition. So we have to pay attention to it. So how did I get to it? My life course was very different from yours. I always knew I needed to be in science, but I didn't know what area. So I studied experimental psychology. I could tell right away I didn't want to be a clinician. I guess you don't do much clinical work yourself, do you?
Not that much anymore, no.
No. So at any rate, and so from there, I just noticed that I was always studying the biochemical basis of whatever we were studying in psychology. And that's how I'm kind of self-taught in whatever biochemistry I have grasped. And if you're going to look at biochemistry in terms of anything psychological, you're looking at nutrients. Even though physicians in medical school or in, you know, medical students are not taught that very often, that's the essential aspect of linking nutrition to brain function. But then I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I looked at a couple of different postdoctoral fellowships, one involving nutrition, but it was not a good track for me because of the nature of the research group. So I thought, well, I'll learn more about neurophysiology. So I did a postdoc in neurophysiology and then proceeded to embark on a career. This was down in the States in neurophysiology, doing animal research, and didn't really enjoy that. And then had the opportunity to move up to Canada and study clinical research aspects of childhood behavior. And that's what led me to this. And one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about it is that I spent my career here in a pediatrics department. I know that my work and the work of others can protect the developing brains of children. I know that you're having trouble with the male there, but when you read chapter 12 in my book, my co-author and I, Julia Ruckledge, talk about our vision for the future. One aspect of that is to protect those developing brains from being exposed to medication for as many years as possible. And we know we can do that with various steps that we walk through in the book.
So let's take the journey of a human being. I think that'll act as a nice backdrop to thinking about the role of food and nutrition in our health, mental health. At what age do we start to see the effects, the negative effects on brain function, brain structure, brain metabolism through inadequate macro and micronutrient intakes?
Well, I'd have to say at birth. I mean, there's a wealth of information, mostly from developing countries, showing that the nutritional intake of a pregnant woman has an impact on the growth and development of her child, and that includes brain function. So it's everywhere, it's every day, it's every month of every life. We are dependent upon feeding our brains, and our ancestors knew that. The thing that is most troubling to me is that I've lived this period of time where ancient wisdom has been lost, and it's been lost. It hasn't been just forgotten. It's been buried by the so-called psychopharmacology revolution, which I observed emerge in the 60s and 70s. And during my training period in the 70s, and everything that was known about nutrition as being so critical for mental resilience just disappeared.
Study after study have showcased that there's this correlation between what you put into your body and the effects. But can you take us through some of the key work that you've done through your own research, which has shown this association and how it affects mental health?
Sure. I'd like to embed it in, I usually think of it as four kinds of data. And my own research is really in the fourth category, but I think it helps to see it all together. So over the years, since I'd say the 1960s, there have been at least a dozen really good nutritional epidemiology studies. These are population-wide. They've been done all over the world, and they've all shown pretty much the same thing. That is that in countries where people are eating a whole foods kind of diet, yes, we have concluded it's healthier, but I mean, when they were doing the research, it wasn't certain. But when people were eating more whole foods, more fruits and vegetables, more of a Mediterranean style diet is how we usually think of it, that population wide, there was less depression and anxiety. And if you looked at the groups that were eating within the populations that were eating less of that kind of whole foods diet, there was more symptomatology of mood and anxiety. So now this is only correlational, and correlation really can't prove anything. And to be very honest with you, I wish people would stop getting funded to do correlational studies in nutrition and mental health, because there's so much out there now. But it's an important clue that there's some relationship and it needs further investigation. Well, the second step, and it's harder to do, but it consists of a fewer number of studies, but very good ones from Australia, from the States, from Canada, showing prospective longitudinal studies. Actually, a very good one from Spain. I'll mention the Spain one is up to illustrate how this is done.
This was the Sun Project.
The Sun Project. And the Sun Project, I think, is better known for its work on cardiovascular symptoms, etc. And so their work in mental health, but they had about 9,000 people who were mentally normal. They had no known mental disorders. They were evaluated for how closely they were following a whole foods Mediterranean style diet. And then people just kind of sat back and waited to see who would be diagnosed with depression. And the slide I usually show is from their six-year data, and it showed it 6 years. And this is really interesting. When you divided people into thirds so that you had the people who were very adherent to a Mediterranean style diet, they didn't look that different from the people who were somewhat adherent. So the medium group. So what that said was, you know, it's okay to eat a chocolate chip cookie occasionally, right? But they were basically following decent diet. The people who were not adherent at all, who were eating really much more of the SAD diet, as you referred to it, very highly processed diet, they had a very high rate of diagnosed depression. And that's been replicated in Australia, and also in a group of children. And this is, maybe I should have used the Canadian studies on children, because whenever I talk about this, I feel like screaming, what are we doing to our kids? Because you can predict who is going to end up with a diagnosis, who's going to be referred for mental health problems based on characterization of their dietary intake 2 to 3 years prior. That's been shown in a group of children in Nova Scotia. It was published in Pediatrics in 2019. And the investigators included some from Alberta. And it's shocking, both from the point of view of, as I said, what are we doing to our kids? But also they did a cost analysis, Dr. Ranney, and that was very revealing, because for every additional health behavior to which these children adhered, and most of them were dietary, for every one, there were 15% fewer referrals for mental health care. So think about the decrease in suffering. Mm-hmm. Think about the decrease in cost to our healthcare budgets. And think about if we could get everybody to adhere to one or two more health behaviors, how we would change society. That's the second type.
Yeah. Now, I was just going to add, because as a young parent, and folks listening would know, I've got two young ones, Aiden is 5 and Eva is 2.5. As a young parent, we immediately see the effects of sugar. And I was speaking with Dr. Lustig on the last episode about the role of sugar in our health. And, you know, they jump up around, the energy levels, etc. And there's a lot of conversational correlations between sugar and mental behaviors in children. But what's interesting is the direction you're going in is it's not just the addition of something in our food. It is the absence of other important cofactors, minerals, vitamins in the food, which is leading to that. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. That's such an important issue to me. And it actually goes back to research I did in the 1980s. We did a randomized controlled trial that was published in Pediatrics in 1989, I think it was. And we showed that some 4 to 6 years old who had came in with really a lot of disinhibition and hyperactivity and impulsivity, et cetera, that when we gave them under completely blinded conditions, which is hard to imagine, but we succeeded with the blind. And when we put them on a clear diet that did not have additives and sugar, et cetera, there was a significant improvement in their behavior. And so we interpreted it as the so-called additives were causing problems. But in those days, we weren't thinking about what else was changing. Maybe it was because when you take the highly processed stuff out of your diet, what are you eating? You've got to eat something. So you're eating things that are more nutrient dense. But we had no way of looking at that then, or maybe we didn't have the foresight to look at it then. And I think that that's true in the sugar literature. You know, I thought a lot of the sugar literature is confounded by, for example, your two children, when you see them reacting to sugar, are you sure it's the sugar or is it the food products which the sugar is in? And is there other stuff in there? Or is it the absence of the micronutrients? Because when we fill ourselves up with 50%, as we're doing now, 50% of what we put in our mouths has virtually no micronutrients. I mean, my co-author, Julia Ruckledge, one day said, you know, they'd probably be better off eating the boxes because at least they'd get some fiber.
That's very good. So you were describing a sort of 4 phases. You've done 2. So there's...
Right. This is why we wrote the book, by the way, Dr. Rani, is that the public doesn't know this. And this book is written for the general public. So now we know that diet is correlated with mental health. And now we also know that dietary intake can predict mental health problems. So the next step is to say, well, what can we do to improve mental health problems with a nutrition lens? Yeah. And that's the other 2 kinds of research that have gone on. So the whole of diet research, there are very few studies. There are only 3 that I can usually cite, and because I think they're really well done. And they are all from 3 independent laboratories, but they all happen to be from Australia. And what all 3 of them have shown is in randomized trials. Now, when you do a whole of diet intervention, there's no placebo, but there's an active comparator. So what in all 3 cases, they were comparing teaching people about the advantages of a whole food diet and how to change their diet to a Mediterranean style and comparing that to peer support, social support, that kind of thing. And all of them found a big improvement in mood. They were all dealing with people with depression. They were all adults with depression. In one study that was dealing with people who had major depression, there was a 32% remission rate in 12 weeks. Now, I have never heard of an antidepressant that resulted in a 1/3 remission rate in 12 weeks with no side effects, of course. So that's very powerful. And that study, I think, got more media attention than any other study in our entire book. I wish the media had a greater interest in the whole picture. But anyway, that one attracted their attention. So that kind of study, we need more of them. We need more maybe with children. I really feel that's very important. But at least the consistency tells us that we should be teaching our patients, our clients, with mental health problems. We should be educating, and this is in at the end of our book where we talk about our vision for the future, mental health challenge or with mental problems in the family, to eat a better diet. It's absolutely worthwhile. And you hear about so many side effects. I'm sleeping better. I'm thinking more clearly. I'm, you know, et cetera. So that is a really strong area. My own research and the research of my co-author has been, we sometimes think of our research as proof of principle. We've been studying the use of broad spectrum micronutrients in pill form. Now, I would like to tell you why I have trouble calling them supplements. I will call them supplements for this interview, but in my view of the world, someday people will be taught to improve their diet. And if that's not sufficient, and we should talk about why that might not be sufficient, then they will be taught to take broad spectrum micronutrients in pill form. And if that's not sufficient to resolve their mental health issues, then of course, there are all kinds of other things on the table, from cognitive behavior therapy, psychotherapy, social support, meditation, breathing, exercise, you name it. And also for some people, a bit of psychiatric medication. So in my worldview, medication should be the supplement.
Thank you for tuning in. We will continue this conversation in the next episode. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite channel so you don't miss it. The Edge series is available on all major platforms.